Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. David Hume is famous, and rightly so, for making the claim that reason is and ought to be only the slave of the passions, which he tells us in Book 2, Section 3, Part 3 of his Treatise of Human Nature. Now, this is a very pessimistic view about human reason and its capacity to engage these other parts of ourselves that we call the passions or emotions or drives or desires, isn't it? But the picture is not quite so stark as David Hume paints it in this wonderful rhetorical passage. And it's good to take a look at the context of this. He's talking about the very possibility for what we call a conflict between reason and passion, something that other philosophers and people in ordinary life take us to be experiencing a good portion of the time. I am angered by what I perceive to be an insult by somebody, but I think about the consequences, so I don't act upon that anger. I reason with myself, oh, I'd better keep my anger in check. Or perhaps I even reason in another way and say, perhaps that person didn't really mean it. Is it rational to be quite so angry? Maybe I should count to 10, right? And I thereby put that passion at least on the side, if not underneath the rule of reason. We can think of many other examples having to do with other emotions, having to be present with another person when you're feeling sad, or restraining the joy that you feel over something that you think you shouldn't feel joyous about. And we could go on and on and on. Hume is saying that these sorts of conflicts always turn out to be won by the side of passion. As a matter of fact, you might say it's a no contest. So he says that we really improperly speak of the combat of passion and reason. Here's the passage. Reason is and ought to be only the slave of the passions. And then he says, and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. Now, isn't that a rather strange thing to say if it's so intuitively obvious that this is the case, that reason can never do anything other than serve and obey the passions? If that's the case, then perhaps reason is only a rationalization of what it is that our emotions or drives or desires or passions are bidding us to do. And Hume says, I realize that this is somewhat extraordinary as an opinion, so we should confirm it by some other considerations. Now, he's saying other considerations because he's already brought up one really important consideration, and that is that reason has, as he calls it, no original influence on the will and thereby on our actions. That means that reason is not able to originate, not able to be the origin or font or beginning place for any of the decisions that we make. Doesn't mean that reason plays no role. It just means that there always has to be some emotion, some desire, some thing that's moving us. And then reason discovers proper means to that end, or looks around for how, you know, something can be brought about, or compares things against each other. Perhaps it's we have a desire for something and reason says, aha, this will satisfy that desire. But reason by itself is unable to motivate us to do anything according to Hume. He brings up another consideration which has to do with the nature of passions. What is a passion? He tells us a passion is an original existence. Isn't that an interesting turn of phrase? He says, or if you will, modification of existence. Now, what does he mean by that? A passion is something that is real. It's something that we feel within ourselves. It's part of our experience, and it is what Hume in other places will call an impression. There's a difference between the idea of anger, or a memory of being angry and then actually feeling angry or feeling desire or feeling fear. And we can go on and on through the entire list of emotions if we want to. By calling it an original, it means that it's not a copy of anything else. It is what it is. And it originates itself, you might say. We feel what we feel without it being merely something that is being produced by remembering that feeling in the past. So he says, it doesn't have any representative quality which renders it a copy of any other existence or modification. This is a very important point for Hume's argument. Because it lacks any representative quality, the anger, the hatred, the sadness, the envy, the joy, the desire, the love that I feel just is the emotion that I feel. He also says that when I am angry, I am actually possessed with the passion. In that emotion, have no more a reference to any other object than when I am thirsty or sick or more than 5 feet high. So not only does it not have a representative quality, Hume goes so far as to say that these have no reference to an object. And you might say, well, that's a little strange, because when I'm happy because of X. Or X makes me happy. Humans say, well, that's the cause of it, but the emotion itself, you're not thinking about that thing, that you're feeling the feeling, right? That's what the emotion is. Even anger, which is definitely an emotion oriented towards something, you're feeling the anger, and then you're just kind of looking for things to be angry at. And the anger itself doesn't have any necessary reference to an object for Hume. That may be a little bit of a stretch for some people when it comes to philosophy of emotion. But it's very important to think about what this actually gets him. Because there's no representative quality and no reference to an object, this means that, strictly speaking, reason and passion, they're not even on the same playing field, and they can't be opposing each other. So to use the anger example, he says, 'tis impossible that this passion can be opposed by or contradictory to truth and reason, since this contradiction consists in the disagreement of ideas considered as copies with those objects which they represent. So insofar as we're feeling the emotion itself cannot be unreasonable. It cannot be contrary to reason. It also can't be reasonable. It's just not working in the same dimension as reason or truth, for that matter. Hume would be perfectly willing to say that our feelings are our feelings and we feel them, and they're not even like true or false insofar as they're our feelings. They just are. They're original existences, as he said. Now, that presents a view of reason and emotion and motivation and will and human desire and actions that seems to put reason entirely aside. And maybe in that case, reason really only can be the slave of the passions. First, we have to feel something, we have to desire something or be averse to something. And only after that can reason show up on the scene, sort of like a servant saying, what is it that you want, boss or my lord, or pick whatever locution you desire for that, right? But there's a little bit more to the story the way that Hume is telling it to us here. He does tell us that emotions can, in fact, be accompanied by a judgment or an opinion. And he says that nothing can be contrary to truth or reason except what has a reference to it. And so the judgments of our understanding have this reference. So passions can be contrary to reason when they're accompanied by a judgment or opinion. Now, in this case, it's not the passion itself that is unreasonable and being opposed by reason. It's the judgment or opinion. So you might say this is sort of an appendage to the emotion. And he says, according to this principle, it is only in two senses that any affection, any affectivity, can be called unreasonable. What could make an emotion unreasonable? What could make, to use the examples, a hope or fear, grief or joy, despair or security unreasonable? Well, when it's founded on the supposition of the existence of objects which really do not exist. So Fear, for example. Some people are afraid walking into a room of what might be in that room, even though the room is empty. It's an unreasonable fear because they have no good reason to think that the object that they're afraid of, spiders perhaps, are actually in the room and likely to hurt them. Likewise, grief, right? We can say you feel bad about something, some loss that you had. Well, what if you didn't actually have that loss? Let's take a car, for example. You forget that you left your car in a parking lot somewhere, and instead you think you've left it outside of your house, and you walk outside and you're like, oh crap, my car isn't here. And you kind of look around, go down the street a bit. Oh, my car must have been stolen. Where could it be? I feel so bad. Well, that's unreasonable because you're the dummy who left your car in some parking lot somewhere. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you a funny story about that. I was working as a security guard in a massive office building, and we had a few parking structures, and there was a man who had parked his car in another parking structure, not one that we actually took care of, on New Year's Eve. And he came in, I was working third shift, around 2 o'clock after, you know, having had a lot to drink. And he had found, going back to his car, that the parking structure was completely locked up and he could not get his car. And he was telling us about it. And we looked at him and we said, buddy, that's not our parking structure. Here's the number you can call, but you're going to get an answering machine because it's New Year's. And he got very upset, angry, sad. But much of what he was doing was quite unreasonable. None of his emotions were going to make anything better. He wasn't going to affect us because we couldn't do anything whatsoever. And you're not going to get in touch with anybody on New Year's Day to try to get your car out of hock. So we suggested to him he find a hotel and stay there. And I don't know what became of the man, but that would be a perfect example of basing one's emotional reactions on things that don't really exist. They're not really the case. What's the other way in which our passions can go wrong in terms of the judgments that are being made? Hume says that sometimes we can select insufficient means for bringing about what it is that we desire or are trying to avoid. So he says, in exerting any passion in action, we choose means insufficient for the designed end and deceive ourselves in our judgment of causes and effects. So if I'm in love with somebody and really want to go out with this person, and I think that showing up at their workplace with the boombox above my head, like in that silly 1980s movie, is somehow going to move that person to reciprocate my love, I am choosing means that are clearly insufficient. Sufficient to that end. I might do better to, I don't know, ask the person out or bring flowers or do something like that. Another good example of something, you know, perhaps at the other end, if I think that I'd like to go out with somebody because I'm feeling amorous towards them and I send them a carefully worded email in the form of a memo, perhaps that's an insufficient means as well. And we could go on and on and on. People do this in terms of anger, thinking that the actions that they're selecting are the proper means for expressing or acting upon that anger, only to find out that they've gone way too far or attacked the wrong person or didn't go far enough and didn't actually affect the person. So Hume thinks that those sorts of judgments made following an emotion, they can certainly be off base. They can be in conflict with reason. They can be false. Now, if that's really the case, he tells us that reason can, in fact, demonstrate this to us, and these passion then will yield to reason. So it's not really the case for Hume that it's always so black and white. Reason is and ought to be only the slave of the passions. Sometimes reason is sort of a slave in the sense that it's looking out for the passions' best interests and helping those unruly passions to find their way to something better. And sometimes those passions will actually yield to reason. He gives you a prime example. He tells us that a passion can never in any sense be called unreasonable, but when founded on a false supposition or when it chooses means insufficient for the designed end, it's impossible that reason and passion can ever oppose each other or dispute for the government of the will and actions. How so? Reason tells the passions, knock it off. He says, the moment we perceive the falsehood of any supposition or the insufficiency of any means, our passions yield to our reason without any opposition. So in some respects, Hume is completely consistent in saying that reason is always the slave of and serves the passions, but it serves it in such a way that it might actually, in some cases, bring about the cessation of a passion that would seem to be opposing reason. But it'll be because we desire something else instead. So you could say that passion still rules the game.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.